Reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradiobreathing.org.
Hello, this is Will Evans, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the recent issues of the Jamestown Post-Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Leading off, discussions, studies continue for best options for Chautauqua Lake. This is from Bemis Point. Although this year was a pretty good year, there continues to be weed problems in Chautauqua Lake, with various studies looking for a long-term solution. On Tuesday, the Chautauqua Lake and Watershed Management Alliance held a public information session where they invited representatives with the State Department of Environmental Conservation to discuss the management plans and objectives with the lake, including addressing invasive macrophytes, harmful algae, and starry stonewort investigations. No permanent solutions have been proposed, although officials believe they are closing in on an action plan. To kick off the discussion, former Assemblyman Andy Goodell, who is a board member of the Chautauqua Lake Partnership, said the relationship with the DEC has improved tremendously. That has led to a better path when seeking the best options for treatment. Goodell noted the challenges of treating various invasive species and the cost, noting that it can run between $700 to $1,200 per acre. Chad Staniszewski, the acting regional director of DEC's Region 9, noted that although they have a regulatory role, they're doing other things as well, including an internal loading study. I'm told that when this study is completed, we will have some additional information to determine how much of the nutrients are actually coming from the sediments that actually exist in the lake, he said. Staniszewski believes if they can quantify that, they can develop an actionable phase where we're actually doing something in real work to address that. Staniszewski said they also want the permitting process to be more workable and more flexible. A.J. Reyes, an aquatic ecologist and certified lake manager with GEI Consultants, said their role is to provide objective scientific advice for the Alliance. They also work to bring different partner groups together. The idea is to have somebody that is sort of overall looking at the general direction, somebody who can work with the aquatic plants, work with the water quality, work with the fisheries, work with the regulators to sort of have a unified vision moving forward, he said. Reyes acknowledged the different groups with different perspectives for lake management, but said the cooperation among them has vastly improved. No successful lake management gets done when you have groups opposing each other because lake challenges themselves are so insurmountable in a lot of different ways, he said. Reyes noted there has been a lot of data collected from the lake over the years. He wants to see that data turned into everyday management. He noted that some years are going to be worse than others, so they need to be flexible when developing treatment plans. Staniszewski said he hopes the data from the DEC's internal loading study will be shared publicly in the next month or two. After that, he believes a report from that data will be produced somewhere around January 1st. Staniszewski was asked that once a plan is proposed, who will implement it? He admits that's unclear. To be honest with you, I don't think we know. I think it's going to be a collaborative effort between the county, the lake management groups, and the state to implement a plan, Staniszewski said. Reyes says it's important to finish the studies first. I can't tell you how many lakes I've worked on that have a harmful algal bloom problem and just jump to a solution instead of actually looking at things because they get too tired of either past studies or anything like that, and they end up wasting a lot of money, he said. Justin Brewer, an aquatic biologist with the DEC's Bureau of Fisheries, said his role is to protect and enhance the fishery. He said any plans created will need to make sure the fish population remains healthy and protected. City woman charged again with endangering welfare of children. A Jamestown woman has been charged with endangering the welfare of children for the second time this year. At 7:30 p.m. Monday, city police officers responded to a home on the city's north side for a reported domestic incident. Serena L. Penhollow, 35, of Jamestown, was charged after officers found the home had a quantity of rotten food, accumulated trash buildup, animal feces, and a plethora of bugs. Penhollow was charged and taken to the city jail until she could be arraigned. The children were placed in the care of a relative, and CPS was notified. Penhollow was also charged on January 22nd with three counts of endangering the welfare of a child after officers responded to a Northside home following reports of children potentially living in deplorable conditions. During the investigation, it was found that Penhollow had three children under the age of 17, allegedly living in deplorable conditions with feces, trash, and other garbage strewn about the home. City police have filed the charge of endangerment, the welfare of a child, 34 times from January through the end of March, the latest data available through the State Division of Criminal Justice Services. Instances of endangering the welfare of a child in the city had been on the upswing from 2021 through 2024, increasing from 80 charges in 2021 to 87 in 2022, 117 in 2023, and 156 in 2024, before a decrease to 135 in 2025. This year, the city was on pace to match the 2025 level of endangering the welfare of a child cases through the first 3 months of 2026. Jamestown police use the charge more often than any other police agency in Chautauqua County. In 2026, Jamestown's 34 endangering the welfare of a child cases account for 73.9% of the county's 46 total cases. Countywide, there were 141 endangering the welfare of a child cases filed in 2021, increasing to 163 in 2022, 198 in 2023, 223 in 2024, and decreasing to 203 in 2025. Jamestown accounted for 56.7% of those cases in 2021, 53.4% of endangering the welfare of children cases filed in 2022, 59.1% of endangering the welfare of a child cases filed in 2023, 69.9% of endangering the welfare of a child cases filed in 2024, and 66.5% of endangering the welfare of a child cases filed in 2025. From Randolph now, Randolph School Board pledges better communication. Randolph Central School Board members have spent the summer reflecting after the defeat of its 2026-27 budget, and the board is pledging to do a better job communicating with district residents moving forward. Board members sent a letter to district residents recently thanking voters who cast votes on two defeated budget votes, as well as teachers, staff, administrators, and other employees. The letter was signed by board members David Adams, Louise Boutwell, Eric Brown, Kyle A. Brown, Daniel Jackson, Julie Milliman, and Lacey Philibad. Since the votes, the board has reflected on what happened, how we reached this point, and what we need to do differently, the board's letter states. People voted no for many reasons, but one message has become clear. We owe you better communication. One of the board's most important responsibilities is helping the community understand why difficult decisions are being considered. Looking back, we did not do that well enough during this budget process. While the district's financial issues were discussed during open board meetings and shared through social media and community groups, board members said they didn't make the information easy enough for the broader community to find and understand, and didn't create enough opportunities for public discussion. After the first budget defeat, additional information was made available on the district's website, and more explanation was given. But board members said those efforts should have come sooner. We should have spent more time listening, answering questions, and explaining the district's finances before asking residents to consider an increase of this size, the letter states. We recognize that trust has been strained. Some residents opposed any tax increase. Others believed the increase was too much at one time or felt they didn't have enough information before voting. We understand that repeating the same explanations will not rebuild trust. Trust must be earned through our actions. The community will not always agree with every board decision, the letter states. However, residents should expect the board to listen, explain its decisions honestly, and accept responsibility for the results. We owe you openness, honesty, and the opportunity to understand not only what decisions are being made, but why. Board members said they have kept tax levy increases as low as possible over the past several years because, at the time, the district had a strong fund balance and had received audits from the state comptroller's office that raised concerns about the size of the district's surplus. Temporary COVID-19 aid from the federal government supported programs during and shortly after the pandemic, while also limiting the need to increase local taxes. When the temporary aid ended, continued use of the fund balance couldn't support the cost of programs. Though the board continued to be conservative with requested tax levy increases. While understandable, these choices left the district with less flexibility, the letter states. We could have done more to prepare the community and address the growing gap sooner. At the same time, the district chose to finance $1.8 million in costs associated with Child Victims Act claims that added a recurring cost to the budget. Health insurance costs have increased 55% since the 2021-22 school year, adding $1 million to the district's budget. The reassessment of Allegheny State Park lowered property tax rates, but caused the district to appear wealthier under the state's school aid formula and limited the amount of aid the school district received while the tax cap limits how much the district can increase taxes without a 60% supermajority vote from the public. In simple terms, one state formula assumes Randolph can raise more money locally while another restricts how quickly it can do so, the letter states. The overall result is straightforward. The district's cost increased significantly while its ability to generate enough ongoing revenue became more limited. The result of those issues was a $27,021,901 2026-27 budget proposal that came with a 19.27% increase in spending and a 39.75% increase in the district's property tax levy. The initial budget proposal was defeated 313-191, or a 62% disapproval rate in May. The board put up a revised budget totaling $25,996,501 with a proposed 19.75% tax increase in June. That was defeated by a 602-491 vote, or a 55% disapproval rate. The second budget defeat locks Randolph into a contingency budget for the 2026-27 school year. That budget includes using $836,000 from the district fund balance as a funding source, while the board has asked district leadership not to spend nearly $750,000 authorized dollars in the contingency budget. While that money remains in the budget, the board is working to reduce actual spending and lessen the district's future reliance on the fund balance. These restrictions will require difficult choices, and the board must consider their effects on students, employees, district organizations, and long-term financial health, the letter says. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Jamestown Post-Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And we'll turn now to our next article. City gets $549,000 in fusion from state. The city of Dunkirk has received nearly $549,000 in temporary municipal assistance aid from the state of New York. Comptroller Tracy Smith Dengler reported the news during Tuesday's Common Council meeting. "We have recently received a couple of large sources of revenue," she began. $1.04 million in sales tax has come in that will certainly help our cash flow for the foreseeable future. We also had a lovely surprise from the state of New York. A temporary municipal assistance aid was received totaling $548,000, just under $549,000. Although all municipalities received some of that money, we did receive a larger share than we were anticipating. That is a blessing. Smith Dengler offered budget and audit updates as well. The 2025 audit, the fieldwork, has been completed, and all of the information is in the hands of our auditors, she said. They are busily working on the final statements, which are scheduled to be completed as anticipated in the fall. Smith Dengler continued, "I will be meeting with our handlers from the Office of the State Comptroller next week, in addition to our insurance agents. Just a meet and greet with both teams and find out where we stand from the state's perspective, and find out what sort of other benefits our insurance agents can provide for us. They have a very large, comprehensive menu of services, and many are included with the fees we already pay." Regarding the budget, she stated that, "In my opinion, when I first met it a month ago, was more than a little challenging. We have done some restructuring and tried to streamline and simplify that document." Smith Dengler added that due to recent changes in city government structure, such as the combination of the clerk and treasurer offices, an updated organizational chart has been issued. Next up now, Slice of Sherman. Annual Sherman Days event draws a crowd. The cows were mooing around the pen, but the chips were slow to fall at Cow Chip Bingo, one of the many popular activities at Sherman Days, which were held from July 31st to August 2nd this year. Cow Chip Bingo is a game where participants buy squares on a grid, and the winner is determined by where a cow drops its waste. The Sherman grid had 100 squares, and chances cost $10 each. The winner received half of the proceeds, and the Sherman Days Fund received the other half. "So you might win up to $500, said village clerk Jeanette Rahm. There were two separate cow chip bingo games on Saturday afternoon. The games were held at 1 and 3 p.m., but after the 2:30, no chips had fallen on the grid. An adult longhorn was originally placed in the pen, but was replaced by two calves in hopes of getting better results. Sherman Days draws a large, enthusiastic crowd each year. Although it kicks off on Friday evening with two live bands, a bonfire, and an alumni dinner at the school, the big event is the parade at 11 a.m. on Saturday. The office of Grand Marshal of the parade was shared this year by Joyce Ayers and Larry Fardink. As she introduced them, Sherman Mayor Colleen Meter said, "As we honor and celebrate 250 years as a country, we also celebrate those who have dedicated their lives in service to this community. This year's two Grand Marshals both exemplify service to this community." Ayers served on the Mayville VFW for 50 years and as a Stanley Hose Auxiliary member for 36 years. She recently retired after 15 years as an assistant crossing guard for Sherman Central School. Fardink has served 62 years with the Stanley Hose Company and is a member of the fire police. The theme, 250 Years of America, was carried out through the plethora of events that took place. Saturday began with a 5K run/walk at 8:30 a.m., followed by the parade, a chicken barbecue, and basket raffles at the Stanley Hose Company. A cornhole tournament was held at 1, a duck race took place at 2, and horse-drawn wagon rides were available from noon to 4 p.m. at Edmonds Park. Activities also took place at the Yorker Museum, where visitors could explore the historical buildings, listen to a dulcimer band, enjoy refreshments, and learn spinning and weaving techniques of an earlier age. Pony rides were made available by Faith Haven Stables in front of the museum. Sherman Days were to culminate with a car show slash competition on Sunday. Participants hoped to win one of three trophies handmade by Amanda Meter, who co-owns and runs the Cooler Bar and Grill. However, the car show had to be canceled because of predicted thunderstorms. Sherman Day organizer Michelle Emery posted the cancellation on Facebook. "The decision was made with the safety of our participants, vendors, and spectators in mind," she said. "We appreciate everyone's understanding and hope to see you all at future events." Moving on now, Linden files complaints on water meeting site. James Linden has filed code violation complaints about the Village of Fredonia's July Water Project informational meeting. The former Fredonia trustee has become one of Village Hall's stiffest critics since getting voted out of office and found another avenue of dissent with the July event held at the town of Pomfret's new hall. The former church has not been renovated yet, and Linden sent a letter to the village detailing his calls for an investigation into use of the building for the water session. Linden asked for his letter to get read out at a Board of Trustees meeting, and Treasurer Erlissa LeBeau did so. Linden wrote he filed a complaint about the July event with five separate state authorities and offices, along with the U.S. Department of Justice. This filing documents a coordinated circumvention of the New York State Uniform Fire Prevention and Building Code and Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, he stated. By co-hosting and directing village residents into an unaltered, uncertified church building, this administration acted in violation of existing state building code, which strictly prohibits public assembly used prior to the formal issuance of a certificate of compliance and created an immediate safety risk by operating the venue without a legally calculated or posted occupant load sign, Linden continued. Furthermore, because this board possessed prior knowledge of this facility's outstanding handicap accessibility and bathroom deficiencies, as recorded in public hearing minutes, staging a civic meeting at this location violates state law and federally protected civil rights, Linden alleged. He added, "The assertion by local officials that the building was exempt because it is not in use yet is legally incorrect. A building undergoes a change of occupancy the exact moment its doors open for a new public function. Verbal clearances from local staff cannot override state building codes, nor do they shield this village from severe liability or invalidation of municipal insurance policies." Linden even claimed knowingly violating the building code is a Class A misdemeanor. He stated that his letter constituted a formal notification of the investigations to the village. And our next article carries the headline, "Second Amendment Groups Sue New York Over Glock Handgun Ban." One of the latest targets in the legal battles around gun control laws in New York is New York's ban on Glock-style handguns. California, Maryland, Connecticut, and New York have all passed, and their governors signed, laws that restrict the sale, transfer, manufacture, or importation of certain Glock-like or Glock-style handguns. California's law became effective July 1, 2026. Maryland's will be effective January 1, 2027. In Connecticut, Their prohibition is effective October 1st, 2026. New York's goes effective May 31st, 2027. Existing owners can generally keep what they already own. Law enforcement and military exemptions are standard. These laws are sold as bans on machine gun convertible pistols or convertible pistols. In 2025, Maryland legislators heard from investigators looking into the use of Glock switches, devices designed to convert semi-automatic firearms into fully automatic firearms, who found the devices posed what they say is an unprecedented threat to public safety and law enforcement officers. In California, in April 2025, gun owners of California's Sam Paredes laid out what he believes these bans are unconstitutional. Glock, the single most popular firearm for self-defense in the world, especially here in California and the United States, they are ubiquitous, Paredes said then. The Supreme Court in Bruin came and said that any firearm that is in common use for lawful purposes is protected by the Second Amendment and cannot be banned. That's the first reason where this thing is going to go to court immediately if it is signed by the governor. That lawsuit against California's ban is pending, with a Biden-appointed federal judge recently refusing the Trump administration's effort to block the state of California from banning the sale of certain types of handguns. Legal Newsline reports that DOJ has alleged that the new state laws are unconstitutional. But, unlike California's law, New York made violations punishable by up to 7 years in prison. Plaintiffs in the lawsuit against New York's ban note the U.S. Supreme Court has already told New York it is out of step on the Second Amendment in the case of New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin. Now, plaintiffs say they're arguing the state cannot ban one of the most popular handgun designs in America. Lawmakers in New York are doing nothing more than continuing their unconstitutional assault on law-abiding citizens who want to exercise their Second Amendment rights in peace, Second Amendment Foundation founder and Executive Vice President Alan M. Gottlieb said in a statement. Making someone a criminal for selling or transferring a handgun merely because someone can illegally convert those firearms into something they are not is absurd. It's already illegal to convert these pistols into machine guns, and the conversion itself requires possession of other illegal items. But lawmakers persist in focusing on the handgun and not the criminals who will continue committing crimes with or without this new law in place. The Second Amendment Foundation, the National Rifle Association, Firearms Policy Coalition, two private citizens, and a licensed dealer sued New York. SAF says factory stock Glock and Glock style pistols have a cruciform trigger bar, and that design feature alone now meets New York's definition of a convertible pistol. Once the law takes effect in New York on May 31, 2027, selling or transferring them becomes illegal. Glock and Glock pattern pistols use a polymer frame that houses the fire control group. There is no separate lower receiver like a rifle. A small illegal part can be inserted to turn the pistol full auto. Illinois advanced a similar bill through a committee this year, but it didn't advance when the session ended. As for whether Glock itself will redesign its guns for these big states, Paredes doesn't think it matters. The author criticizes Glock for doing nothing about this issue. In fact, they did so with their generation for Glocks, Paredes said. They modified them so the Glock switches could not be applied and all of them in the future. The problem is the state of California prevents Glock from selling generation 4 or 5 and now 6 in the state of California because of the unreasonableness of the roster. California already maintains a restrictive roster of handguns approved for sale. Manufacturers must prove to state regulators that their guns meet specific safety and testing requirements. Legal challenges to California's roster are pending. This next article is from Greenbelt, Maryland. Ex-Fauci advisor pleads guilty to plotting to conceal COVID-19 research records during pandemic. A former senior advisor to infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci pleaded guilty Tuesday to plotting to conceal federal records related to research on the origins of the deadly COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. David Morins is scheduled to be sentenced November 12th by U.S. District Judge Paula Zinets in Greenbelt, Maryland. Morins pleaded guilty to conspiring to defraud the U.S. government, a felony punishable by a maximum prison sentence of 5 years. By pleading guilty today, Dr. Morins has taken responsibility for what he did, and he will continue to do so, defense attorney Tim Belovetz said in a statement after the plea hearing. Morins is accused of using his private email account to intentionally circumvent public records laws while employed at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. The Justice Department alleges that he concealed or destroyed records of discussions related to COVID-19 research grants, including an effort to revive a controversial coronavirus grant. The indictment follows a probe by House Republicans into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic that scrutinized Morin's email communications and accused him of intentionally concealing records. In congressional testimony, Morins denied attempting to evade federal transparency laws by using his personal email. In July, Fauci repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination during a congressional hearing on his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. Last Friday, Fauci declined a request to appear voluntarily before a second Senate panel after majority Republicans on the Homeland Security Committee voted along partisan lines to hold him in contempt of Congress. Fauci wasn't charged in the case against Morins, who's 78, of Chester, Maryland. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Jamestown Post-Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And we'll turn to the opinion page now, and our first opinion article carries the headline, How Can DEC Not Know How Much Waste Is Actually Recycled? We'd say New York should throw out its recycling data, but we're not sure if the paper would be recycled or end up in a landfill. Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli office found the state DEC lacks reliable information on how much material is recycled across the state. Part of the problem is recycling facilities have submitted only about 2/3 of the required annual reports from January 2021 through December 2023. The facilities that did submit reports couldn't always verify the information they did report. And perhaps most troubling, of the reports that were submitted, nearly 2/3 were missing required information necessary to determine how much waste was actually recycled. There's a final issue, too few inspections of the state's registered and permitted recycling facilities. More than 1/3 of the state's 389 recycling facilities were not inspected during the 3-year audit period. And of the 33 facilities that didn't file annual reports, only 3 were issued violation notices. Inspections are important because they are DEC's primary tool for verifying the information facilities report and identifying potential compliance issues. The audit also found enforcement actions were limited. Although 33 facilities failed to submit any annual report during the audit period, DEC issued violations to only 3 facilities. Reliable recycling data is essential to understanding how much waste is being diverted from landfills and incinerators through recycling, DiNapoli said. If recycling data is incomplete or inaccurate, the state can't effectively evaluate whether recycling efforts are working or track their impact in reducing state waste and its environmental impact. We couldn't agree more. Most people believe in the idea of recycling. It's good for all of us to reduce the amount of garbage that makes its way into landfills, and even better, to reuse as much material as we can. The fact that the DEC has no idea how much of the state's waste is actually recycled is ludicrous. If the state can't handle administering recycling programs, how much faith should we have in the state's ability to administer the rest of its costly environmental policies? Columnist Froma Harrop writes our next article, "Are Mainstream Democrats Taking Back the Wheel?" You couldn't find a wackier candidate than Francesca Hong, the Democratic socialist vying to become the governor of Wisconsin. She wanted to defund police and abolish ICE, topping it all off with a call to end Thanksgiving Saturday Night Live couldn't have made her up. Hong lost the Democratic primary, but left behind some sobering thoughts. She finished second by only a hair and against a sterling Democrat with relevant experience. The winner, David Crowley, is the Milwaukee County executive and an African American born into poverty. Crowley will face off against Republican Representative Tom Tiffany, a MAGA right-winger who voted against certifying the 2020 election. GOP-aligned groups spent heavily to promote Hong's candidacy for obvious reasons. You know who put Crowley over the top? Rural Wisconsin voters. Over in Michigan, the wily Abdul El-Sayed, endorsed by the fringe left leaders, beat Democrat Representative Haley Stevens by a similar tiny margin. She did extraordinarily well in working class areas in and around Detroit. El-Sayed flew to victory on the wings of college towns. Could normal Democrats build an alliance between the urban working class and rural voters? That might become a more pressing requirement if El-Sayed loses to Republican Representative Mike Rogers, which will probably happen. El-Sayed has burned bridges with many Jewish voters, a constituency Democrats have traditionally relied upon. He also has his inflammatory influencer friend, Hassan Piker, who said America deserved 9/11, hanging around his neck. Rogers is an establishment Republican who defended the 2020 election results that made Joe Biden president. He has since veered more toward MAGA and won Donald Trump's endorsement in the Republican Party. But Trump undoubtedly figured that Rogers would have a better chance of victory in the swing state than a fire-breathing right-winger. And a Rogers win in November could keep majority control of the Senate in Republican hands. Are we done with polls yet? Polls issued right before these primaries showed both Hong and El-Sayed beating their opponents by double digits. The photo finish results suggest the pollsters know nothing. But belief in their findings can alter election outcomes. A Marquette poll from March showed Crowley supported by only 3% of Democratic primary voters. He left the race believing that Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez would be the stronger Democrat. He also didn't want to split the mainstream Democrats' votes. When Rodriguez would later dropped out due to finance accounting problems, Crowley jumped back in. Looking forward to 2028, the Democratic National Committee has chosen South Carolina as the site of its first presidential primary. That makes some Democratic socialists uncomfortable. In 2020, South Carolina played a major role in making Joe Biden the Democratic nominee over Bernie Sanders. In earlier contests in Iowa and New Hampshire, the generally white and college-educated electorate had sent Sanders toward the head of the pack. Come South Carolina and the other Southern Democratic primaries with their huge African-American voting bloc, Biden shot ahead. It wasn't because the voters were conservative, as Sanders grumbled. It's because they cared more about health coverage, racial fairness, and income inequality than the left's boutique issues, defunding police, transgender rights, and the obsession with identity politics. What did Latinx mean? Mostly, It was the belief, a correct belief, that Biden could beat Trump, and Sanders could not. Black voters favored Biden over Sanders by 4-1. Moderate Democrats may be finally putting up effective resistance to the highly organized fringe left. Step one is reorganizing primaries to better reflect the preferences of the Democratic mainstream. Step two is getting Democratic nominees out to vote. Step three is to build on issues regular people care about. They can do it. Washington is the source of our next article with the title, Kennedy Center Tells Court It Won't Try to Restore Trump's Name to the Building Before September 8th. The Kennedy Center has told a federal court that it would not attempt to return President Donald Trump's name to the building's facade before at least September 8th as another legal battle over the performing arts venue's future takes shape. In a status report filed late Tuesday, opponents of the move said members of the Kennedy Center's Trump-aligned board seem intent on defying an earlier court order requiring the Republican president's name to be removed from the building. The Kennedy Center said it would not move forward with the plans until after Labor Day at the earliest to allow time for legal arguments. Lawyers for Representative Joyce Beatty, an Ohio Democrat who is an ex officio member of the board, pressed U.S. District Court Judge Christopher Cooper for an earlier ruling, arguing there is every reason to believe that defendants will attempt to effectuate some or part of this latest unlawful resolution at the earliest opportunity after September 8th. A board meeting this month that was expected to largely focus on options to close the Kennedy Center for renovations instead transformed into another push to attach Trump's name to the building, part of a broader move by the president and his supporters to leave a physical mark on the nation's capital. The board passed a resolution to name the plaza in front of the building after Trump and add his name to the venue's facade, so it would read the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, restored and renovated by President Donald J. Trump. In the filing, Beatty said the board also agreed to add an additional reference to the president if the Trump-Kennedy Center Fund reached $100 million. In that event, the facade would read the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, restored and renovated by President Donald J. Trump, endowed by the Trump-Kennedy Center Fund. The board also voted to back a 2-year closure for renovations, while some of the institution's signature programming, including the Kennedy Center Honors and the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, would take place at off-site locations. The National Symphony Orchestra announced this week it would split its upcoming season between 6 venues in and around Washington. Cooper ruled in May that letters affixed to the building spelling out Trump's name were added illegally, and he ordered their removal, a decision that the administration failed to persuade courts to overturn. Since then, a tarp has covered the area where the letters were once installed, frustrating those who sought to be removed the president's name from the building. In the latest filing, the Kennedy Center made no commitment to remove the tarp, saying the covering was in place to facilitate the removal of Trump's name and is part of a broader system needed for water testing and structural repairs to the roof overhang. More broadly, Beatty's lawyers questioned the integrity of the board's vote this month, echoing concerns Cooper raised when he called a March vote to shutter the building ill-formed and seemingly preordained. Heading into the August meeting, the Kennedy Center's management said it would provide the board with 3 options, including a complete closure or a partial closure that would allow some continued public access and limited programming in spaces unaffected by the work. A 3rd option would consider a highly limited series of phased closures to address only the center's most serious infrastructure needs, while scheduling and maintaining a full slate of programming. In Tuesday's filing, the Kennedy Center, said a Delta Consulting Group analyst concluded that a partial closure that would play out over 4 years would increase the length and cost of construction and lead to substantial safety concerns. The analyst recommended that the board proceed with a full closure for 2 years, which would minimize total cost, minimize the amount of time that programming would be subject to disruptions from construction, and best preserve the center's reputation as world-class performing arts venue, the Kennedy Center said. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Jamestown Post-Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And we'll turn now to the To Your Good Health column. This is written by Dr. Keith Roach. Woman with back pain inquires about strengthening devices. Dear Dr. Roach, I'm a 77-year-old woman with degenerative disc disease. I had an L4 microdiscectomy surgery in 2020, but I still have chronic pain in my lower back. Although I do core strengthening exercises with physical therapy, which helps, I'm still in daily pain. I've been seeing advertisements for multifidus muscle strengthening devices, such as NeuroMD and Relive X. What's your opinion on this type of exercise device? That letter's from CK. The doctor's answer, I think that better non-pharmacologic therapies are needed for back pain, and the theory of electrical stimulation to strengthen the back muscles makes sense. The multifidus muscles run on either side of the spine, stabilizing the joints between the vertebral bodies. Weakness and atrophy of these muscles are strongly associated with back pain. The devices that you mentioned are called neuromuscular electrical stimulation devices, and they have a complementary action with exercise. Unfortunately, the published data supporting their use aren't strong. Some studies do show an improvement in muscle strength, and one study did show a reduction in back pain. But other studies didn't show a benefit when compared to a control group. Some of the expert groups issued guidelines that haven't yet recommended the treatment for chronic back pain, citing a lack of proof. A well-designed study is apparently underway. I did read a handful of reports of adverse events, mostly around unpleasant electrical shock sensations, but the studies found a low incidence of side effects. I can't recommend it based on the lack of strong evidence of its effectiveness at this time, but this may change with further studies. Our next letter, Dear Dr. Roach, I'm a 70-year-old man. About 8 weeks ago, I began having sweats, chills, severe headaches, body aches, a low fever, a lack of appetite, a lack of energy, and numbness around my waist. As this progressed, I began having severe pain in my lower back and left shoulder blade. I lost 24 pounds. I went into the hospital twice and had many tests, MRIs, EKGs, and CT scans done of my belly, head, spine, etc., as well as many blood and urine tests. I was also checked for viruses, tick, and mosquito-borne diseases, and many other possibilities that all came back negative. The myriad of symptoms didn't correlate to a specific cause. Fortunately, after 8 weeks, I started feeling better. I have Crohn's disease and a permanent ileostomy, but doctors didn't see this as a viable cause. Do you have any ideas? That letter's from DK. The doctor's answer, Crohn's disease is a consideration, but the fact that the CT scan was negative makes this less likely. I suspect that your doctors ordered a stool test called fecal calprotectin, which is very good at detecting active Crohn's disease. If they had a high degree of suspicion, they would have done an endoscopy. The combination of symptoms that you had isn't specific, and it sounds like your doctors thought about and tested you for most of the common possibilities. I've had more than a few patients with similar symptoms as yours where an exhaustive evaluation failed to turn up a cause, and they got better without treatment. In such cases, we suspect an infection, a viral one most commonly, that your body finally fought off. Viral infections can sometimes trigger a condition called transverse myelitis, which might explain your most unusual feature, the waist numbness. This can also go away spontaneously. A return visit to your general doctor is still a good idea, as some conditions wax and wane before getting diagnosed. Some cancers are good at hiding, especially lymphoma and myeloma, so follow-up blood testing is a smart idea to be sure, even if it's unlikely. We'll move over now to the Dear Annie column. This is written by Annie Lane. Nothing to lose and a sister to gain. Dear Annie, my granddaughter, Melanie, thinks she has a half-sister 24 years younger. Melanie believes that her father, long divorced from her mother, was asked by his former unattached girlfriend, with whom he remained friendly, to help her have a child before it becomes biologically too late. Now, my granddaughter has become very attached to the 2.5-year-old and visits her at least once a week. She finds a lot of physical resemblance to herself when she was that age. She sees her father participate lovingly in the little girl's activities. She has asked him the question, but he refuses to answer, telling Melanie to address the question to the child's mother, whom he sees every time she goes to visit the young child. However, she cannot bring herself to asking the mother if this girl is her half-sister. What should she do? Nat letters from Wondering Grammy. Dear Wondering Grammy, Melanie has nothing to lose and a sister to gain. She's already spending a lot of mental energy on the subject, and her dad actually told her to ask the child's mother. So she should go ahead and ask, if she wants to know. But right now it seems that she's not totally sure she does. Perhaps deep down she's uncomfortable with the idea of her father having another child. I'd explore that with her to help her sort out her feelings so she can come to peace with this issue either way. Next letter, Dear Annie. I wanted to add one more point to the cigarette butt conversation that I feel you and the reader should have mentioned, as it is incredibly important. People who throw out their butts along roadways can and do cause wildfires, some of them causing death and destruction across vast areas. With this being wildfire season, we need to be more aware of how our habits impact the earth and those around us. That letter's from Concerned in the Northwest. Dear Concerned in the Northwest, you are absolutely correct. According to the National Fire Protection Association, there were an estimated 90,000 smoking material fires in the United States in 2011, the most recent year for which this data is available. Those fires caused an estimated 540 civilian deaths and 3 times as many injuries. Discarding cigarette properly can literally be a life or death issue. Thanks for bringing attention to this aspect of the problem. Our next letter, Dear Annie, like childless with no regrets, my husband and I also decided not to have children. After 33 years, we don't ever regret being childless either. To this day, when I see a baby, I smile and comment how beautiful he or she is to the proud parents, and am truly happy for them, but have no desire to hold the little bundle of joy. However, if I see a puppy, I go gaga, turn to mush, and snuggle the little pup in my arms and talk baby talk to it. I remember when I was a rebellious teen, my mother would tell me, "I hope when you have kids, they turn out to be just like you." That was enough for me to swear off having children. That letter's from Dog Mom in Missouri. Dear Dog Mom, bundles of joy come in all shapes and sizes. Millions of pups need parents, so it's wonderful that you were able to take one into your home. Thanks for sharing your experience with not having children. I'm printing your letter for people who are facing peer pressure to have children when they'd rather not. And we'll take a look now at the Today in History column. Today is Thursday, August 20th, the 232nd day of 2026. there are 133 days left in the year. Today in history, on August 20th, 1968, the Soviet Union and other Warsaw Pact nations invaded Czechoslovakia to crush the Prague Spring Liberation Movement. Also on this date, in 1858, Charles Darwin's theory of evolution was first published in the Journal of Proceedings of the Linnean Society. In 1862, the New York Tribune published an open letter by editor Horace Greeley calling on President Abraham Lincoln to take more aggressive measures to free enslaved people and end the South's rebellion. In 1866, President Andrew Johnson declared the official end of the Civil War. In 1882, Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture had its premiere in Moscow. In 1910, a series of wildfires swept through parts of Idaho, Montana, and Washington, killing at least 85 people and burning more than 4,600 square miles. In 1920, the American Professional Football Conference was established by representatives of four professional football teams. 2 years later, with 18 teams, it would be renamed the National Football League. In 1940, exiled communist revolutionary Leon Trotsky was attacked in Coyoacan, Mexico, by assassin Ramon Mercader. Trotsky died the next day. In 1964, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Economic Opportunity Act, a nearly $1 billion anti-poverty measure. In 1986, postal employee Patrick Henry Sherrill went on a deadly rampage at a post office in Edmond, Oklahoma, shooting 14 fellow workers to death before killing himself. In 1889, 51 people died when the pleasure boat Marcianus sank in the River Thames in London after being struck by a dredger. In 2012, after 80 years in existence, Georgia's Augusta National Golf Club, home to the Masters Tournament, invited former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and South Carolina financier Darla Moore to become its first female members. Both accepted. In 2023, Tropical Storm Hillary struck Baja California, killing three and causing $15 million in damage. And here's some today's birthdays. Boxing promoter Don King is 95. Former U.S. Senator diplomat George Mitchell, 93. Rock singer Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin is 78. Country singer Rudy Gatlin is 74. Singer-songwriter John Hiatt is also 74. Actor-director Peter Horton is 73. Actor Joan Allen turns 70 today. Movie director David O. Russell is 68. Rapper KRS-One, Boogie from Boogie Down Productions, is 61. Actor Colin Cunningham turns 59. Actor Billy Gardell is 57. And rock singer from Limp Bizkit, Fred Durst, turns 56 today. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from recent issues of the Jamestown Post-Journal. We read from the Jamestown Post-Journal every Saturday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Will Evans. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the Niagara Falls Review. At 8 o'clock, we have Off Duty from the Wall Street Journal. And at 9 o'clock, we have Sports Illustrated. Stay with us for these readings and more.
Thank you.
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability,